Coming up on this week's book show, Simon Winchester, author of The Professor and the Madman and the Perfectionists, examines what we human beings are doing and have done with the billions of acres that together make up the solid surface of our planet. His new book is Land: How the Hunger for Ownership Shaped the Modern World. Simon Winchester on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Simon Winchester, author of The Professor and the Madman and The Perfectionists, offers the notion of property, our proprietary relationship with the land through human history, how it has shaped us and what it will mean for our future in his new book, Land: How the Hunger for Ownership Shaped the Modern World. Land, whether meadow or mountainside, desert or peat bog, parkland or pasture, suburb or city, is central to our existence. It quite literally underlies and underpins everything. The book examines in depth how we acquire land, how we steward it, how and why we fight over it, and finally, how we can, and on occasion do, come to share it. Ultimately, Simon confronts the essential question, who actually owns the world's land, and why does that matter? It is a great pleasure to welcome Simon Winchester back to The Book Show. It's always a great pleasure to have you on this program, sir.
Joe, it's lovely to be here. Thank you so much.
Again, the name of the book in full is Land: How the Hunger for Ownership Shaped the Modern World. Of course, you are known for taking these enormous subjects and making them palatable, making them, allowing us to read about their history. What drew you to the land?
I had lived in Hong Kong until 97, when China retook it from the British, as rightly they should have done. And so I came and lived in America, where I had been a correspondent in the 70s and the 80s. And because I like the countryside, bought a little cottage in Wassaic, New York, Dutchess County. And that cottage had about 5 or 6 acres around it. But there was a man who came up from the Bronx to hunt in the land surrounding the house. And he used to leave me venison and a bottle of brandy to thank me for letting him hunt and so forth. But then he said one day, would I like to buy the land? And it was about 130 acres. And the price he suggested was affordable, just. And so I said, yes, why not? And so all of a sudden, I found myself owning 130 acres or so of essentially useless but rather beautiful land on the north face of a mountain. So you couldn't really grow anything there, but it was beautiful. There were little streams and lots of, you know, trees, oaks and cherry and hemlock and so on and so forth, and a fair amount of animal and bird life. And I sort of fell in love with it, but I didn't think too much about it, largely because after a while I moved away from that little cottage and came up to where I am now in Berkshire County, Massachusetts. But I nonetheless kept the land and thought only of it really every time the tax bill came in, and I thought, what am I going to do with this land? But then everything sort of changed in 2011 when I became a citizen of this country, and I suddenly thought that I actually now owned a small amount of the surface of the United States, the country that I was now quite literally invested in. And so I then began to take it rather more seriously, and I used to go down and look at the land and think, well, what shall I do with it, or simply just enjoy it, and then began to look into the history of it, who had owned it before me, and then realized, and it's a fairly prosaic thing to realize, but it was a sort of an epiphany for me, that the people that had first lived on it, the Mohican Indians, had never owned it. They'd never had the notion of ownership. They believed that you could no more own the land than you could own the ocean or the wind. And so I wondered about that. So here I am owning a piece of America, and yet the people that were here originally used it, enjoyed it, but never owned it. And then I thought, this is a subject which could be, if you look at patterns of ownership and how they affect society and the shape of countries and so forth, could be looked at all around the world. And so I persuaded my editor at HarperCollins that I thought I might try and write a book, and she said, go ahead, and off to the races I went, and that the book is the result.
You mentioned epiphany a moment ago, and I felt that in reading it, because there's this idea of there is the land, and the point that it then becomes our land, and even more specifically, my land, which then can go back to our land and the land. And right. And that whole idea is fascinating.
Well, to me, absolutely, Joe. I mean, I would, rather pathetic to imagine, but I would be sort of on my knees picking up acorns or looking at a rabbit burrow or something like that, and I would be sifting the soil through my hands and looking at the dead leaves and so forth that had fallen in the autumn, and I would think, this belongs to me. That is really strange, and in a way, because of the becoming a citizen, sort of beautiful and had a certain sort of synchronous being to it. But at the same time, it seemed somewhat wrong that I really shouldn't own, because, and then I began looking into the history sort of worldwide, and where did the concept of ownership begin? And sort of like many of the questionable things that have happened around the world, it tended to begin in England, and it began in England in the 14th and 15th centuries, because prior to that, essentially all land in England was owned by no one, by God. And, well, technically, because the monarch, the king or queen, was, in the terms of the English, was God's representative on earth, or at least in London, he or she would technically, and this is still true today, technically own the land. I mean, people that own land in England today own it, this rather bizarre term, in fee simple, which means they own a lifelong tenure, that ultimately the owner is the Queen Elizabeth. However, that's sort of slightly getting away from the point. The main point is that in the 14th and 15th centuries and before that, land was held in common. It was common land. And so you would have a village in England, and you would have all the houses, and in the middle, and perhaps around it, was land which was used by everyone. And so someone would graze his cattle, and someone would grow turnips, and someone would have pigs, and someone would have goats, and someone would raise celery or whatever. And that was how villages were organized. But then in the 15th century, because the population was increasing so rapidly, people needed to be fed, there was the feeling that you could actually organize the land rather better, because common land was very inefficient. The cattle would wander over and eat, you know, trample the wheat, and the pigs would eat the turnips, and what was called the tragedy of the commons was created. And so someone came up with the bright idea that maybe instead of the land being held in common, fences should be put up. People should own little tracts of land privately. Farmer A would have his cattle behind the fences, and someone else would grow his turnips behind another set of fences. And all of a sudden, the notion of commonly held land would vanish, and the land would be enclosed. And this is what it was all about, enclosure. And Parliament became sort of apprised of this new phenomenon of enclosure in, quite specifically, 1604. And oddly enough, in a village just beside where I went to school in Dorset in southwest England in the 1950s and 60s, they would say this in a little village called Radipole, the land was going to be enclosed, and Parliament, the clerks, would tack a message, a bill, to the door of the church in Radipole, so everyone could see it. And if anyone had any objections, they were to state them. And if there were no objections, or if the objections were overruled, the land would become privately owned and cut up into little bits. And this had an enormous social effect, because the people who all of a sudden were dispossessed of their land, they no longer had access to it, became, not unnaturally, sort of cheesed off. And some of them went off to live in the cities, which were growing because the Industrial Revolution was about to begin and factories and so forth were being built. And so they go to London and Manchester and Birmingham and Bristol and so forth. Or they would cross the Atlantic and come to the New World, or we'd go down to Australia and New Zealand. And they transported the idea of private land ownership to this country. So an idea that was utterly alien to the people that lived in North America, suddenly the British idea of private land ownership came here to Massachusetts, of course, to Plymouth Rock and Virginia and so forth. So I'm afraid we're to blame, as with so many things, ills of the world today.
So what does enclosure mean today?
Well, enclosure began, as I mentioned, formally in 1604,
right,
and ended, I suppose, in about the late 19th century, by which time all land, effectively all land in Britain that had hitherto been commonly owned, was now enclosed and privately owned. There are one or two places, well, more than one or two, a handful of places that are still commonly owned. Now, you'll be familiar that in the middle of London, there are places like Hyde Park and Regent's Park, but they are owned by the monarch. But the town moor in Newcastle is owned theoretically by everyone. It is still common land, just as it had been 1,000 years ago. And if you're given the freedom of the city of Newcastle, which happens to people from time to time, you have the right to keep cattle or sheep on that common land. And so you can drive across it. There are one or two roads, and it's a very big piece of land. And you'll see in the middle of the city little flocks of sheep and herds of cattle and little plantations of various crops, a sort of image of what Britain must have looked like 1,000 years ago. Someone even took it quite he was given the freedom of Newcastle and decided he would land his plane on the town moor, which of course frightened the sheep and so forth. So it wasn't a good idea, but he had the right to do it. So that's what enclosure was all about. And it had an enormous social impact, as I mentioned. And the other social impact was something vaguely the same, but rather more cruelly enforced. And that was called the clearances. And the clearances largely applied to Scotland, where the big landowners, the Duke of Sutherland most notoriously, decided that because he had tenant farms dotted all over the Highlands, he didn't earn much money, and it would be much more economically advantageous for him, because the price of wool was so high, to turf all those people out and replace them with sheep. And so crofters, as they were called, one after another, they were dispossessed of their houses and turfed off the land quite cruelly. I mean, by having their houses knocked down and their fields burned, just so that this awful man, the Duke of Sutherland, could put sheep in their place. And you go to Sutherland now and you see 200-year-old ruined houses, a sort of reminder of what was happening and what happened to these people. And there were thousands of them. First of all, the Duke said, well, I'll be compassionate to these people and I'll build them a little village on the coast and they can fish. And they said, we've no idea. We've never fished in our lives. We don't know how to fish. And he said, oh, you'll learn. And of course, they didn't learn. And they got very cross. And a lot of them got on ships crossing the Atlantic. And notoriously, a group of them found a ship that happened to stop. They sort of waved and said, stop. And lots of these dispossessed crofters got on it, not entirely sure of where it was going. But it was indeed going across the Atlantic. And it turned up in the winter in Hudson Bay in northern Canada and discharged such of these crofters who had survived. And they now, in the middle of winter, trekked along the Red River, which was nearly frozen, and then camped and founded the city of Winnipeg. So, and one of them was the grandfather of the Prime Minister of Canada, John Diefenbaker. So the social impact of these, sort of the unintended consequences, number one, of enclosures, and number two, of clearances, was profound, and particularly it was felt here in North America, either in Canada or down here in the United States.
Simon Winchester is our guest. The name of the new book is Land. It is published by Harper. I was reading this book, and I was struck by this feeling of the appetite for land, and I'm trying to come to terms with that. And then I felt like a real dolt when I shut the book, and as I was trying to come to terms with it and realize, oh, you have the word on the front cover, which is hunger. I mean, that's such an important word in the story, the hunger for ownership of the land. I'm hoping you can talk a little bit about that, of how that ultimately does indeed shape us, because the land is so intoxicating.
Yes, I mean, I suppose, and this might be a bit of a sidebar, I mean, one of the places where the hunger quite literally weaves its way into the story was one of the places I visited, and that was the Ukraine. The Ukraine is the breadbasket of Russia, if you like. It is the Kansas, it is the Iowa, the Nebraska, where the soil is so rich and black that you think it looks pointless, actually, to pass vegetables through it. You might as well just eat it, stuff it into your mouth, because it looks so good. And it was, when I went there a year or so ago when I was doing research, quite literally the waving fields of grain, you thought, my God, this is just feeding everyone. Well, that was what Stalin thought in the 1920s and 30s, and he was going to, this is now a relatively new communist country, to feed the entirety of the Soviet Union. You needed, in his view and his advisors, to collectivize all the farms, to turn them into gigantic sort of factory farms, not having lots of little farms. And so they commenced in 1932 this policy of collectivization. And the result was absolute chaos. And it became a class war against the Ukrainians, because he insisted that these people be stripped of their land and that huge factory farms be built in its place. Lots and lots of people were shot or sent to the gulags. And as a result of these policies, which went disastrously wrong, there was a famine which killed 10 million people. I mean, we tend to forget the great genocides of the world, the genocide of the Ukrainians by the Russians or by the Soviet Union in the early 1930s, is one of the immense and somewhat forgotten tragedies of this, all to do with hunger, all to do with land, although not perhaps quite in the way that I was thinking when I started this book. And the interesting subset of this story, subtext of this story, this particular story, is that a young Welsh journalist, he was 32 years old, called Gareth Jones, heard rumors when he was in Moscow that there was hunger down in the Ukraine. And so he smuggled himself. You weren't allowed to travel, but he did. And he got down there and he saw terrible sights of people starving to death in the streets of the towns in the Ukraine, Kiev and Kharkov and places like that, and came back to Moscow and then went to Berlin, held a press conference and said, I have seen terrible things, and pieces were written all over the world. The New York Times correspondent, a chap called Walter Duranty in Moscow, who was a very well-fed man with servants and lived a very extravagant lifestyle and was a great friend of and admirer of Stalin, said, oh, no, nonsense, this isn't happening. There may be a few pockets of hunger, but nothing dreadful is happening. But terrible things were happening. He, nonetheless, his view, it was the New York Times, you know, paper of great authority, was believed largely, and he won the Pulitzer Prize. He, Duranty, won the Pulitzer Prize. It was then found out that he was completely in the pocket of Stalin and that Gareth Jones was right. And in recent years, the New York Times has admitted that Duranty was not a good reporter at all. And there have been moves to take the Pulitzer prize away posthumously. He died in the 1950s, I think. And but the Pulitzer Board has resisted all attempts. And there was a recent attempt made about 5 or 6 years ago. But still, they said, no, we gave him the Pulitzer, and he must have it, despite him being 100% wrong in his judgment. And there's a new film called Mr. Jones about Gareth Jones. And I urge listeners to go and see it, because it tells the story of land and what happened in one particular instance that was tragic. And it also tells the story of journalism and journalism gone wrong.
You bring this up in the epilogue, and I think it's so important. And so I want to bring up 2 points in our final moments together. One is what you write in the epilogue is that, oh, and by the way, we're losing our land. The land is drowning. So there's that. Climate change is having a real impact on our land. But also...
Yes, I mean, quote, they're not making any more of it. It's absolutely solid as a rock, quite literally. I mean, remember from Gone with the Wind, what did Scarlett was told by her father when she thought of selling Tara? No, land is the only thing worth working for, the only thing worth living for, the only thing worth dying for. It's the only thing that lasts. Well, it's not going to last, because the sea level is rising, as we now, most of us anyway, believe is a certainty, and whole countries are disappearing, Tuvalu and Kiribati and islands in the Pacific and called Bangladesh as well. So land is not immutable anymore. Land is, and I had to put a caveat at the beginning of the book, it's the basis of capitalism, because if you can take the certain immutable land to the bank and say, I own this, I'm going to use it as surety to allow me to buy a tractor or a car or a refrigerator or whatever, that's no longer true. Land is mutable. Land is slowly but steadily disappearing.
The other point that you make, and it's the more hopeful point in the book, is that in many places, including where you live, in many places, we are coming to this idea that maybe it isn't such a bad idea for all of us to have common land.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I mean, yes, it is hopeful. I mean, the village next to me, New Marlborough, Monterey, so many towns in Massachusetts, in Vermont, as it happens in Oregon and Washington too, are coming around to the idea, and Dutchess County indeed, in where I have a little bit of land in Wassaic, saying that the community should own it. And so people are being approached, if you own some hundreds of acres, why not consider giving it to the local land trust, which means that in perpetuity, we will guarantee that the land will not be built upon. It'll be remain pristine, it'll remain covered with forests and streams and home to wildlife for eternity, but you won't own it. The community will own it. Well, some communities say that's not a good idea because it removes the land from the tax rolls. But the more mature towns, I think, and many of them here in Berkshire County, are coming to the notion that we should do as the Native Americans used to do. Hold it in common, hold it in trust for everyone, because, as the Aboriginals in Australia say, the earth is our mother. We should cherish our mother, and it will look after us.
It is the idea, that idea, which allows us, as I said, a hopeful point, but it really gets us back to the beginning of your story, where that land was communal. So... because the driver of this story, as a driver of so many stories, is greed, right? We want more of that. The land is worth something, and we want more of it.
Yes, and I'm afraid, if I can be a polemicist for a moment, I repudiate that idea. I mean, the idea that John Malone or Ted Turner owns 2 million acres, that Gina Rinehart in Australia owns 29 million acres, and some people have this need, this hunger, to own more and more and more land. And in the case of these notorious, the Wilkes brothers in West Texas, who made a fortune from fracking, to own land and to force people who had hitherto skied on it, walked on it, climbed on it, enjoyed it, no longer to be allowed access to it. That seems monstrously wrong. No, I think maybe people should own a maximum, I mean, I'm not going to put a numerical idea, but 50, 60 acres, and improve it by all means, and perhaps do what the Scandinavians do, which is to the policy, the principle of what's called allemansratten, all men's right, to be on the land as much as you like, as long as you behave yourself. In America, the law of trespass, and remember that America is the country that invented barbed wire to keep people out. The notion of trespass doesn't exist in countries, in particular Scandinavia. So all land for all people, and owned, if owned at all, only in small amounts, and improved, not despoiled. Because, as I said about the Aboriginals, it is our mother. We need to look after it.
The other part of that is that the reason that you also want the land, or that perhaps the motivation for many people, is because of the value. We hear so much about, even today, of what the value of the land is, and to keep that land at a high price. It's a commodity.
Yes, but there is the distinction between the price of everything, and we don't really realize the value of anything. And the value of land is more than mere price. The land is quite truly the foundation of everything. Everything we get, whether it's oil or iron ore, whether it's wood or whether it's the life of animals, everything comes from the land. And I suppose I say that because, well, one, it's true, but also I was a geologist once, and so I have a certain sort of reverence for the land. I think to lose that reverence and just to regard it as a commodity is entirely wrong. And thank heavens that there are some people originally in far northern Europe, well, originally in the indigenous populations of New Zealand, the Maori, of the Aboriginals in Australia, the First Nation people up in Canada, and of course the Native Americans here in the United States, who had that view of the land. I think quite sincerely, profoundly, that we should readopt that view. We are tenants on this planet, and we shouldn't use our tenancy merely as a means of making money. Greed, so far as land is concerned, is something not to be admired. I mentioned at the beginning that the Native Americans, I mean, read Chief Sealth's extraordinary piece of eloquence when he was reluctantly persuaded to sell a couple of million acres of land in the 1870s to settlers who wanted to begin to build the city of Seattle, named after Chief Sealth. And he said, we cannot imagine owning the earth any more than we can own the breeze or own the waves of the sea. I think that's got to be somehow inculcated into the public imagination. And we have changed our behaviors towards certain things. I think we are coming to believe in climate change at long last. We are starting to take the fate of our planet more seriously. We don't pollute as we used to pollute. We find people that throw litter to be abhorrent people. I'm hoping that very slowly our attitude to land will change as well, because it is not good for the planet if we regard our land as simply something to be bought and sold, to be made subject of profit and greed.
Again, the name of the book, Land, How the Hunger for Ownership Shaped the Modern World. The book is published by Harper. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.